This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Do you agree, Mr. Laughlin, that the statement that you gave to Trooper Proctor is not the same as the statement that you gave to these jurors yesterday?
Right? Yes.
Can I just calm you down?
Yes.
When you did make this statement to Trooper Proctor, your visit to Canton PD was coordinated by another officer to put you and Trooper Proctor together for the interview, correct?
I don't recall that.
Do you recall being contacted by a completely different officer to say, hey, Trooper Proctor wants to talk to you, come on into Canton PD, let's have an interview?
I don't remember exactly how the interview was set up.
So that was my next question. You may have just told me this. Do you have any recollection who set that interview up?
I don't.
Does the name Kevin Albert sound familiar?
No.
You know Kevin Albert?
No.
You know him to be a police officer at Canton PD?
No.
You know him to be the brother of Brian Albert?
Objection.
No.
The objection sustained.
That's all I have, Your Honor.
Okay. Lally, any redirect?
Yes, sir.
So, Firefighter McLaughlin, you went to high school with Caitlin Affleck, correct?
Yes.
And could you describe the nature of your relationship, if any, with Caitlin?
I would describe it as we're not close friends. I would say we're more acquaintances. We have mutual friends. I don't have a one-on-one relationship with her.
And you were asked some questions about social media, correct?
Yes.
And if you could, or if you could guesstimate about how many friends, and I'm sort of throwing air quotes in there, how many friends on social media would you have?
I don't know, probably 500.
And of those probably 500 friends on social media, how many of those are actual friends that you talk to, interact with beyond social media?
Much less than that.
Now, prior to, well, let me ask you this. As far as, would you say that you saw Caitlin Albert more so when you were in high school or more so since you have graduated from high school?
I would say probably more in high school because we were there every day, so.
And about what year or so was it that you graduated from high school?
2014.
And as far as any sort of photographs that were referenced to you, have you seen those photographs?
Here?
Yes.
Here today, I saw them.
Do you have any idea where or when those photographs were taken?
I don't remember.
And of those photographs, it's not just you and Caitlin Albert in a photograph, is that correct?
Correct.
So a larger group of people, is that correct?
Correct.
When you were asked about sort of these day trips, they were sort of trips specifically on a day to a beach, it looks like, correct?
Correct.
And to a beach with a larger group of people, is that correct?
Correct.
And with reference to Caitlin Albert specifically, have you ever socialized with her in any setting beyond a setting that contained a large group of people?
No.
Now, with respect to, you went to, you say high school, you graduated from Canton High School, correct?
Correct.
And you grew up in Canton, is that correct?
Yes.
And did you know Caitlin Albert before you attended Canton High School?
No, that's probably when we first really interacted was high school.
And essentially, you live within the town, you work within the town that you grew up in, correct?
Correct.
And is that abnormal from a civil service perspective?
No, from a civil service perspective, you're given more points for residency. So it's actually, I would say, preferred, or you're placed higher on the list if you have residency in that town.
So it's actually preferred and more common than uncommon as far as growing up in a town and then working in that same town in a civil service position like a firefighter.
Yes.
Now, during the course of the time that you've been on the Canton Fire Department, have you received calls to residencies or other places or even patients that you either knew or were familiar with?
Yes.
Would that be a reason for you to not go on a call?
No.
And you have an obligation, wouldn't you say, to respond to a call when a call is made and you're on duty in that station, correct?
Yes.
The objection sustained. Ask the question differently.
As far as when you're on duty as a firefighter at a particular station house and you get a call, what, if any, choice do you have to respond to any particular call?
I don't have a choice. I just have to respond to the call.
And then prior to that date of January 29th, had you ever been over through socialization or otherwise, Caitlin Albert's house?
Not that I ever remember.
Had she ever been over your house?
No.
And again, had you ever socialized with her outside of a large group of people?
No.
When you responded on that morning, just after 6 a.m., the house of 34 Fairview Road, did you know who lived there?
No.
During the time since January 29th of 2022, have you ever spoken to Caitlin Albert about what happened that morning in front of 34 Fairview Road?
No.
Now, you were asked some questions on cross-examination about knowing sort of Caitlin Albert's parents' names or siblings' names or things of that, correct?
Right.
And prior to January 29th, you didn't know any of those names. Is that correct?
No.
You learned them subsequently. Is that correct?
Yes.
May we approach just briefly?
Okay.
So, Ms. McLaughlin, you learned of other people's names within the Albert family subsequent to your response to this call on January 29th. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you learned of those through sort of various news or media reports in relation to this case, not something that you had any conversations with anybody about, correct?
Correct.
I have nothing further.
All right.
Your Honor, if I may, I have...
Okay. Okay.
You indicated, Ms. McLaughlin, that Mr. Lally just asked you about these 500 friends on social media. A couple of quick questions about that. Of those 500 friends on social media, how many of those have you taken day trips with?
I don't know.
How many of those have you gone to the beach with?
I don't know.
How many of those have you posed for photographs with?
I don't know.
How many of those have you posed for photographs in swimwear with?
I don't know.
How many of those have you been photographed with your arm around while that other friend is drinking a beer?
Sustained. Sustained.
Ms. McLaughlin, all of those things that I just mentioned, you have done with this Caitlin Albert.
Objection, Your Honor.
Sustained.
That's all I have.
Okay. All right, Firefighter McLaughlin, you are all set. All right, jurors, we are getting ready to go for our view. So we're about to visit a place which you'll be hearing about some more. You've heard about, you've seen photographs of. And in court terminology, we call this view. The purpose of the view is to help you better to understand the evidence, which you'll hear during the trial, and to help you appreciate the location and its surroundings. The view that you will take is a part of this case. The observations that you make while on the view may be used and considered in your deliberations in reaching a verdict. The place that we're going to go, you've seen photos of, you've heard, it's 34 Fairview Road. The lawyers and I will accompany you on the bus. The attorneys may point out to you the arrangement of the scene and items that they want you to pay special note of, but otherwise they cannot discuss anything in this case in regard to this case, and they can't talk to you. All right, they'll be able to do an opening here, and they'll be able to point these things out. While you're on the view, it's very important that you can't take notes, and you certainly can't use your phones and take photographs. All right, it's really just for you to see. You cannot conduct any independent investigation while we're there or at any time during the trial, as you've been told. You're not to return to the scene or ask anyone else to do it for you until the case is over. So this is your opportunity to take a look when we go. What you are to do on the view may be best summarized in two very familiar words, which is stop and look. Okay. Your responsibility is to see the place, to observe it carefully, and to remember what you see. So during your trip to and from the place that we're going to view, you're not to discuss this case or anything about it among yourselves or with anyone, and you are not to permit anyone to talk with you about the case. You'll be under the supervision of our great court officers at all times, and you'll remain together until you return to court, unless the court officers direct you otherwise. And just so that you know, because some of this came up during our jury selection process, spectators, if there are any, and all members of the press have been ordered to stay 100 yards away from you. All right, so you can go and you can look and take your time looking without worrying about any interference from anyone. All right, so with that, Mr. Clerk, could you swear in, please, the court officers?
Court officers, raise your right hands, please. Do you solemnly swear you will take this jury upon the premises in question and there suffer them to view the same and any property, place, or thing bearing upon the issues on the trial as they shall seem necessary, that you not permit the parties to enter in a debate in front of the jury or a person to speak to them unless it be Adam Lally for the Commonwealth and Alan Jackson for the defendant, they to point out such places or things as they deem expedient for the determination of the issue, and that you will keep the jury together until they shall return into court, except the court shall otherwise order, so help you God.
Thank you.
All right, so who, Mr. Lally, do you want to do a short view opening?
Yes, thank you.
Okay.
So ladies and gentlemen, as Her Honor just described, we're about to go to a place. When we arrive there, and at any point in time when we're there, this is not a point where we can have any sort of conversation or back and forth. So all I'm going to be asking you to do is just take note of certain locations and certain items as you see them. And again, as with anything in this case, this is as you find them, as you observe them, okay? So first I'm gonna ask you to sort of, when we arrive in a general area as far as taking note of sort of street names when you're coming into and when you're exiting from this particular area. When we arrive at a specific location, I'm gonna ask you to take note of certain things about the roadway. Certainly any abutments to the roadway, any residences that you observe, the distances between the roadway, and any landmarks or any items that you observe on that property, specifically a driveway, specifically a front door, any other sort of items of interest within the front lawn area of that home. I'm also going to ask you to take note of the roadway itself and sort of the width of that roadway, whether or not you find any sort of lanes separating within that roadway and then the individual width of some of those lanes as well. Lastly, there is also going to be a vehicle there as well. And I'm gonna ask you to take note of certain things with respect to that vehicle, okay? With respect to the size of the vehicle, with respect to the height of the vehicle, with respect to anything that you observe specifically from the front, the side, the back, all of the exterior of that vehicle, and then also some of the interior of that vehicle. And specifically, I'm going to ask you to take note of sort of the center console in the front driver's compartment of that vehicle and anything that you observe in that location as well. And that is all I'm asking you to do on this case. And I thank you again for your time and attention.
All right. Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's the first time we've been able to speak to you directly, so I want to take the opportunity to introduce myself and thank you for your service and thank you for your time and commitment to this. I'm going to echo a lot of what Mr. Lally just said. There's nothing magical about this, other than it gives you perspective. It's an opportunity to introduce you in three-dimensional form to stuff that you've been seeing in two-dimensional form. Photographs, some of the testimony, diagrams that you might see.
I'm sorry, we're really pointed on what you can say.
What we're going to ask you to do is take special note of the relationships of physical items out of the scene. Much as Mr. Lally just indicated, there are going to be physical things out of the scene. You've heard about a flagpole, a fire hydrant, a house. We're going to ask you to take special note of where those are in relation to other things physically at the scene. That will hopefully, with the court's instruction, give you some assistance in putting together the testimony that you think is relevant, the documents that you think are relevant. Again, to echo what Mr. Lally said, we're going to ask you to look at the roadway, the vehicle, the house, the physical items at the home, and the relationship between and among all of those things to each other. Hopefully, that will give you a very good understanding of what we're dealing with, especially with the exhibits. Thank you.
All right. So, folks, we'll be all set. We'll see you at the bus in a little bit.
Just make sure your notebooks are closed.
You are muted. Goodbye.
Quiet, please.
Okay. Your Honor, I'm so sorry for the false start. I wanted to make one final record on the court's ruling. I respect the court's ruling on the
go ahead, you can make your record.
Maybe it would be better if I did it over here. I wanted to interpose an objection to...
So I think it would be better if you did it over here.
It's illegal. It's just a legal one.
I don't know what you're doing. Come over here and tell me what you're going to do, and then I'll come back there and do it.
May I hear that?
Yes.
Okay. As it relates to the four exhibits that the court deemed were not admissible because of a violation of Rule 14, I wanted to elaborate just very briefly.
Just go ahead.
Our objection. We believe that under Rule 14, we were not obligated to have to present these exhibits to the Commonwealth in discovery. Rule 14 does not require such disclosure when the exhibits are used for impeachment only. And that's exactly what those four exhibits were going to be used for and what we intended to use them for. Had this witness said, I know Caitlin Albert, we've been friends for 10 years, we went to high school together, we've been on day trips together, we've been to the beach together, and we've socialized together, I wouldn't have to show any photographs. But that's not what she said. What she said was, I went to high school with a person named Caitlin Albert, which is a bastardization of the truth. That's not the truth. And those four photographs are what got her in the voir dire process, what got her to admit that she, in fact, does know Caitlin Albert, and those are on a very, very different level than she first suggested. As the SJC has explained in the case of Commonwealth versus Aguiar, A-G-U-I-A-R, at 400 Mass 508, Penn site at 513. It's a 1987 case that says the following, and then I'll finish my record. Quote, a defendant has a constitutional right to bring to a jury's attention any circumstance which may materially affect the testimony of an adverse witness, which might lead the jury to find that the witness is under an influence to prevaricate. It matters not that the evidence would reveal an otherwise inadmissible fact, such as the witness's commission of a crime. A judge may not restrict cross-examination of a material witness by foreclosing inquiry into a subject that could show bias or prejudice on the part of the witness, end quote. And that's exactly what we believe we were entitled to do with Katie McLaughlin as a witness for the Commonwealth. She has bias, or at least the jurors can consider a bias. She has prejudice. The jurors could consider a prejudice because of a pre-existing relationship with Caitlin Albert about which she was not truthful. So I wanted to make that record and ask the court to reconsider whether or not those four exhibits could be introduced. I don't need to make any big deal about it. I don't want to call her back to the stand. But I think the jurors, now having had the description of those photographs, should be able to see them in evidence. And I would submit.
All right, so that request is denied. The record's clear. So Ms. Reed is not going on this view. She just needs to make sure she's back here by the time we return. So, Mr. Yannetti, you're nodding.
Yes,
you will contact her and make sure she's back here.
Understood. Okay.
All rise for the court, please. Please be seated. This court is in session.
All right, so jurors, I want to remind you of the instructions that I gave you before we went on the view, and then I have a caution for you. So we took a view today, the purpose of which was to help you to better understand the evidence, which you'll hear during the course of the trial, and to help you appreciate the location and its surroundings. The view that you took is part of this case, and the observations that you made while on the view may be used and considered in your deliberations. Remember that I told you that what you were to do on that view is best summarized as simply stop and look. Your responsibility was to see the place, observe it carefully, and remember what you saw. You were cautioned that while on the view, you were not to take any notes or photographs, and that you were not to conduct any independent investigation while we were there or at any time during the trial. So independent investigation includes, but is not limited to, any measurements that you may have taken or attempted to take. So to the extent that any of you did that, you must totally disregard it, because you must find the facts from the evidence presented to you in this courtroom. Okay? So with that, Mr. Lally, do you have a witness for us?
Yes, Your Honor. The Commonwealth will call on Mr. Gregory Woodbury to the stand.
Step up to the witness stand, please. Face our clerk and jury.
You solemnly swear the evidence you're recording during the case now here to the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help me God.
I do.
Thank you. Please take the stand.
All right, Mr. Lally, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Could you please state your name and spell your last name?
Greg Woodbury, Woodbury.
And what do you do for work, sir?
Lieutenant paramedic on the Canton Fire Department.
And how long have you been a member of the Canton Fire Department?
About 24 years now.
How long have you had the rank of lieutenant within the Canton Fire Department?
That's been 8 years now.
Now, prior to working with Canton Fire Department, what, if any, other work did you have within that same sort of field?
Prior to being on Canton Fire, I was an EMT paramedic in the North Shore area.
And if you could just, with regard to your working as a paramedic and a firefighter, specifically as far as being a paramedic, mm-hmm. What, if any, sort of specialized training did you receive in regard to, or certifications did you receive in regard to being a paramedic?
So after I got my EMT, when I went to paramedic school, I went to Northeastern University. It was a one-year full-time program.
And following, you successfully completed that program, is that correct?
Yes.
And is there any sort of continuing educational component or recertification component in regard to your paramedics certification?
Yeah, every 2 years paramedics have to recertify. We're required to get so many hours of continuing education to recertify every 2 years.
If I could turn your attention to the date of January 28th, 2022 into January 29th, 2022. Mm-hmm. Were you working with the Canton Fire Department on that day?
Yes.
And what kind of shift were you working on that occasion, if you recall?
It was a 24-hour shift.
And 24-hour shift within the Canton Fire Department is what?
It's 8 a.m. to 8 a.m. the next day.
Now, turning your attention to the 29th, at what point do you sort of get up and start to begin your day at the fire station?
So a normal day, sorry, was that the my beginning of the shift you're talking about or the end of the shift? Okay, so the second part of the shift. Normally we get up at 6 for the officers, but I got up a little earlier then because we had the snowstorm coming in. So I had to make sure everything was shoveled. I think I got up about maybe 5, check the apron of the area in front of the station, and make sure the walkways were clear.
And when you got up to check that, what kind of thing did you...
It had been snowing. There was blizzard-type conditions coming in. So it was a decent level of snowfall there. Let me see. Maybe 2-3 inches on the ground at that time.
And as far as with reference to that, what, if anything, did you do to...
I think we can move quickly through this part of it.
Yeah.
The cleaning the apron?
Okay. As far as that particular date or that shift, how were you assigned within the firehouse?
I was lieutenant on engine 4.
And with respect to that, at some point shortly after 6 a.m., did you receive a dispatch to a call?
Yes. Yeah, we're dispatched to a call for a person in the snow.
And did you respond to that call, sir?
Yes, I did.
And you were assigned to the engine, is that correct?
Correct.
Who, if anyone else, was assigned to the engine that day with you on that shift?
So we had Cade McLaughlin and Frank Walsh were my two engine crew.
And in addition to yourself and your engine, what if any other sort of vehicles or apparatuses?
Ambulance one also responded with us. So that was Tony Flamati, Matt Kelly, and Tim Nuttall had also hopped on the ambulance. He was coming in for the shift in the morning, came in early to beat the storm.
And do you recall where the call was in regard to what the address was?
I don't remember the address offhand, but it was not that far away in the district.
And when you arrived in the engine, when you first arrived on scene, as you were arriving on scene, what, if anything, did you sort of see as upon your arrival?
So the police were already there. We were approaching the scene. I could see several people off to the side in the yard doing something, so we went to investigate that.
When you say off on the side, was that to your left, your right, or something?
So the way I was approaching the street, it was on the left-hand side.
And when you indicate you see some group of people, is that correct?
Yeah, there was a few people around. I don't remember exactly how many or what they were doing.
And when you start to make your way over there, what, if any, what, when you arrive on scene, what is sort of the first thing?
So we went to evaluate the patient. I believe someone had started CPR prior to us getting there. So we went to continue that.
When you say someone had started CPR prior to you.
I don't remember the particular individual that was doing it as we arrived.
My only question, sir, so it's someone outside of your department, correct?
Yeah.
And do you know if it was one of the police officers or someone else?
I don't remember.
Now, obviously, you're dispatched in response to an unresponsive male, correct?
Yes.
And at the time that you're arriving on scene, you say you see sort of a cluster of people. Were you able to see that unresponsive male at that point?
Not in the vehicle, not until I exited the vehicle.
And at some point, much later or subsequently, did you come to learn the identity of the unresponsive male or the patient that you were involved in?
Afterwards, they told me yes. At the time, I did not know.
And what did you learn his name to be subsequently?
I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous and blanking right now.
Was it Mr. John O'Keefe?
Yes, correct.
And when you first came over to where Mr. O'Keefe was on the ground, is that correct?
Yes, he was.
What kind of position was his body in when you first observed?
He was lying supine on the ground, like on his back. He was parallel to the street, about 8 feet away from the snowbank.
And in reference to that, as far as the snow was concerned, what, if any snow did you observe on or around where you were?
He was covered with snow, and there was snow around the area.
And so from a treatment of Mr. O'Keefe as a patient, yep, what is sort of the first thing that you did?
We started CPR, or CCR, sorry, immediately. Someone went to go get a board to get him onto that so we can get him onto the stretcher and move him to the ambulance. And then someone else is trying to get the backstory, trying to figure out the scenario that we're dealing with.
If I could just stop you for a moment. So
yep,
you mentioned CCR, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. So what is the difference between CCR versus CPR?
CPR is cardiopulmonary resuscitation. So that is when you're helping someone breathe. CCR is when we first get to a scene. They changed the protocols a little while ago, so we don't have to give respirations right away. We can just do compressions. It's a little more effective to get the blood flowing quickly.
Thanks. So as far as your involvement in patient care, sort of what yep, was that during that initial phase where Mr. O'Keefe is supine on the ground? What was your involvement in patient care at that point?
I was assisting with the CPR, making sure everyone else was doing their task. As lieutenant, I kind of got to manage the other people and make sure everyone's on target for what they're supposed to be doing.
And during that initial time that you're outside in the area where Mr. O'Keefe is on the ground, what, if any, observations did you make as far as injuries to Mr. O'Keefe at that time?
Outside on the ground, he was covered in snow. So we're really not doing any sort of secondary survey initially. The primary concern is the primary survey, which is airway breathing circulation. He was not breathing. He had no pulse, so our primary concern is to get that going.
And at some point, are you able to get him from the ground to the back of the ambulance?
Yeah, we moved him onto a longboard, then moved him from the longboard onto the stretcher, and brought the stretcher over the ambulance and loaded him in there.
You mentioned at some point, upon your sort of initial arrival at the patient, mm-hmm, that different people were tasked with different things, correct?
Yes.
And someone was tasked with trying to get sort of what you termed a backstory, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Why, yeah, why is that important?
So when you have someone unconscious, unresponsive, you want to know when they were last well, the last breathing, last seen, trying to figure out why someone is on the ground. There are different reasons of why they could be there, trying to figure that out. Normal people don't lay down in the snow, so trying to evaluate the reason the person was unconscious.
And so you're able to get him on, Mr. O'Keefe, onto a stretcher into the back of the ambulance, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Fair to say that the lighting in the back of the ambulance is better than it was outside?
Correct.
And when you're in the back of the ambulance, are you able to then do or participate in that secondary survey?
Yeah, we started doing a secondary survey after we started getting good compressions going. Someone was working on the intubation, and then one of the procedures is to strip off the clothes and evaluate the person.
And if you recall, how were the clothes removed?
I don't recall exactly which method they used. Typically, we cut them off, but I'm not sure if they did that or they just pulled them off.
And what, if anything, do you recall as to Mr. O'Keefe's clothing and sort of what he was wearing when he was found?
I really wasn't paying attention to it. The primary concern is trying to revive him.
So to that secondary survey, as far mm-hmm, as once you're in the back of the ambulance, what, if anything, did you observe as far as injuries on Mr. O'Keefe's back?
He had a hematoma or a bruising. The right eye was very prominent. There was some scratches on the right forearm, was most of the external injuries we noted.
And now, in addition, so as far as people on scene, there were a number of different firefighters from your
yes,
department. And you mentioned that the police were on scene when you arrived, is that correct?
Correct.
So beyond the police and fire, what, if any, other individuals did you observe at some point when you were on scene?
There was some other civilians there. I really wasn't paying attention to them.
Now, with reference to that backstory that you were talking about,
mm-hmm,
at any point in time, either outside of the ambulance or inside of the ambulance, who, if anyone, was tasked by you or anyone else to try and obtain that backstory?
I think Katie McLaughlin was the one that obtained the backstory.
And if you know, was there any other conversation that you were present for between any of your other firefighters and any of those civilians?
That was the primarily when she relayed to us the information that she had obtained. We were trying to figure out the scenario of why he was found unconscious, unresponsive.
Let me ask you this way. So as far as arrival at the patient when he's on the ground,
yep.
Who gets there first? The, you and the other individuals in the engine or the firefighters in the ambulance?
We both respond from the same station at the same time. The engine's in the front. The ambulance usually in the rear. So I believe we pulled over. The ambulance pulled over at the same time as us. I believe C5 went as well, which is the captain. He was also responding with us.
Now, as far as the person that Firefighter McLaughlin spoke to, what, if anything, did you know about that person at that time?
At that time, I knew nothing. I knew that it was someone that had been with him. She relayed the information of what she had heard to us.
And the information that Firefighter McLaughlin, without reference to what it was, but the information that Firefighter McLaughlin was able to obtain, mm-hmm. did she communicate that to you and the other firefighters in the ambulance?
Yes. Yeah, she came in the ambulance, told us what she had heard.
As far as the information that Firefighter McLaughlin provided, did that comport with what you were observing as far as injuries to Mr. O'Keefe?
Objection.
Sustained. You can lay a foundation. If.
Now, as far as, again, the injuries that you observed to Mr. O'Keefe in the back of the ambulance were what?
It was the bruising of the right eye and the scratches on the forearm.
And what, if anything, did Firefighter McLaughlin indicate to you had been told to her?
That someone said she had hit him, and he was last seen.
Objection.
Sustained. That will be stricken.
May we approach on?
Okay.
Because we always try and check and make sure that your lunch is here before we take a break. I'm told that it is. So we will take a lunch break. We'll see everybody here ready to start right at 2:00. All right. Why don't we get the lieutenant back up here? Thank you.
Sir, I remind you, you're still under oath.
Okay.
Go right ahead, Mr. Lally.
So, Lieutenant Woodbury, turning attention back to the treatment of Mr. O'Keefe in the back of the ambulance, correct?
Yes.
With respect to that, you testified that you don't recall sort of specifically anything as far as clothing for Mr. O'Keefe, is that correct?
I was not paying attention to the clothing.
And so to that point, what were you paying attention to at that point?
Primarily the big issue was doing the CCR then to CPR. We're trying to resuscitate the person as best we can. We know with the hypothermic patient, it's very difficult. It's a longer treatment protocol than a typical cardiac arrest because we have to do the CPR for an extended period of time. We have to get the patient warmed up. So the clothing is just quickly removed versus examined or looked at. And the focus was on getting compressions done. Someone was trying to intubate, getting a line started. So that's what we're mainly focused on.
And as far as treatment is concerned, what, if any, sort of interplay or intersection is there between a cardiac arrest and a hypothermic patient?
When someone's hypothermic and in a cardiac arrest, we can't declare them dead or passed on until they've been warmed up. A lot of times with hypothermic patients, they can appear to be dead when they're still actually alive. So there has been instances where people have woken up in morgues that were hypothermic when their body warmed up a little bit. So we have to be very cautious, very careful about treating them as much as we can, as careful as we can. We can't shake them too much, can't move them too much. So it's getting the blood circulating and then starting ventilating after a few minutes.
Back to the CCR, the chest compression that we're talking about. What, if any, sort of, based on your training experience, what, if any, sort of protocols are, well, let me ask you this. Were you doing chest compressions throughout the entirety of this interaction with the patient?
No, chest compressions, most people do them about 2 minutes. After 2 minutes, it's very tiring to do chest compressions, so we swap off every few minutes. So a different person will come in and do the compressions. They'll do it for a little while, go into a different task. Someone else will come in and do compressions.
Is that sort of the protocol that you followed in this instance? With
yes. Yes, we were rotating the person doing compressions.
And the ambulance at some point leaves the scene and goes to a hospital, is that correct?
Correct.
And do you know what hospital, Mr.
Good Samaritan Medical Center.
If you could just wait till...
Yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. Yeah. Good Samaritan Medical Center.
And did you go along for that ambulance ride?
No, I did not.
Where did you go?
So as the lieutenant on the engine, I stay with the engine. I detailed my two other engine personnel to the ambulance. So they went with the two engine personnel, the two regular people on the ambulance, as well as an additional person. Timmy Nuttall was the extra person for that one.
And so you take the engine and go with?
I went back to the station.
And at some point, shortly after that, are you called back to the roadway of Fairview Road?
Yes.
And same general area of Fairview Road?
Yes, same address.
And how is it that you get from the station back to Fairview?
So we had struck a box to cover the personnel that we had detailed. That means we send out a page looking for additional people to come in. We had Sam Pock come in. So he was my engine driver. And I was in the lieutenant seat. We responded back in engine 4.
And the ambulance that had been there on Fairview Road with you previously was at Good Samaritan.
Stuff, yes. Right? Yeah, a call like that takes an extended period of time, even at the hospital, to assist them there. So we had to get an ambulance from Station 2.
And if you know, who was on that ambulance from Station 2?
That was Jason Becker and Dan Whitley.
Now, with reference to this particular call, what, if anything, was this secondary dispatch with regard to?
So this call was for a Section 12, which is someone in having a psychological issue.
And do you know who that Section 12 was in regard to?
Yeah, this was for Karen Reed.
And at some point, you go back to the scene along with the engine and the second ambulance from Station 2?
Yeah, so the engine got there first. The ambulance coming from the other station, so it was a couple extra minutes before they got there.
And when you arrived, who, if anyone else, is sort of on scene on Fairview Road?
The police were still on scene. They had never left. So initially it was me, Sam Pock, and the police. So I went up to try to get the backstory of why we're doing a Section 12 and what was going on.
And at some point, well, when you first arrived, without regard to what was said to you, but who, if anyone, do you speak with to sort of try to gain this information or backstory?
When I got onto the scene, I talked to the police that was there.
Who did you talk to, sir? The police officer
who
was
officer.
There?
Yes. Sorry.
And do you recall specifically who that police officer was?
I really did not pay attention to the individual officer.
And at some point, do you have a conversation, or what, if any, conversation do you have with the patient? The defendant is reading.
So it was when we identified Karen Reed as the patient, the ambulance arrived shortly after. We started talking to her and trying to get her into the ambulance to talk to her further.
And just to be clear for the records, when you say Ms. Reed, you see her in the courtroom today?
Yes, she's right over there.
That's a record reflect identification of the defendant by the witness?
Yes.
Thank you. Now, with respect to the defendant, Ms. Reed, where is she sort of when you first make contact with her on scene when you come back?
In the general vicinity of where the police cars are.
And what is sort of the purpose of this initial conversation that you're having with Ms. Reed?
For Section 12, that's when someone's made threats to them, harm themselves or others. So I just had to judge her mental ability at the time and if she was a threat to us and how much of a threat she was to herself. So just a quick evaluation, see how her behavior was.
And what, if any, observations did you make of her during your quick conversation?
She appeared very distraught, very upset. Initially just trying to explain the situation to her about going to the hospital with the Section 12, and she was resistant to that.
And so when you say she was resistant to that, what if anything, did she say or do to...
She did not want to go...
Hold on. You cannot talk over each other. The objection's overruled.
Yeah. Okay.
Please go ahead.
So what was the question again, please? Yeah.
So... what, if anything, when you say she was resistant, what, if anything, did she communicate to you or observations did you make in regard to that?
She did not want to go to the hospital, and she didn't think she needed any assistance.
And what, if anything, are you sort of, you mentioned you were explaining sort of the process to her. What, if anything, are you saying in that explanation?
Well, once a Section 12 gets written, it's written by the police. Once it's written, we are required to transport to the hospital. Section 12 means that they believe you're a threat to yourself or others, so you have to get evaluated at the hospital by the hospital staff there to see how mentally stable you are.
Now, at this time of this conversation, what, if anything, did you know as far as the relationship between Ms. Reed and the prior patient, Mr. Oki?
I knew they had a relationship. I wasn't sure if they were married or engaged or what their status was, but I knew she was did have a strong relationship with him.
And in reference to Mr. O'Keefe, during your conversation with Ms. Reed, what, if anything, was she asking or saying in reference to Mr. O'Keefe?
She kept repeating, is he dead? Is he dead? She seemed very concerned about that. We're trying to explain to her that we cannot declare him dead. He's being evaluated. He's being treated. They're trying to treat him the best they can.
And as far as when she's stating these things to you, is this, as far as the sort of tonality of her voice while she's stating these things to you, can you describe that?
She was very up and down. It was a repetitive conversation with her. She's obviously experiencing a lot of different emotions. Her emotional state was all over the place.
And as far as this sort of second time that you're on scene, about how long period of time are we talking?
That was about between 15 and 20 minutes.
And as far as your conversation with Ms. Reed, where did she go? Did you stay with her sort of the entire time that she was on scene that second time? Or?
Because she was resistant, we were trying to get her to voluntarily go. If someone voluntarily goes, even with the section written, they're released a lot quicker. So we're trying to convince her to go, be willing to go with us versus being forced. If at some point we have to actually force her to go against her will, then it's going to be a much longer hospital stay. So our main goal with staying on the scene so long was to try to get her willingly to go. Just makes her experience much better.
And just to be clear, when you say we, who specifically are you?
It was me, Dan Whitley, Jason Becker were the ones talking to her in the back of the ambulance.
When you clear, or when you leave the scene, where is Ms. Reed at that point?
So the ambulance transported her to the Good Samaritan. We also detailed Sam Pock as the driver.
So the gentleman who had driven, or the firefighter that had driven you in the engine to the scene that drives the ambulance away.
Yes, correct.
Would you say his name again, please?
Sam Pock.
Sam what?
Sam Pock.
Spell it, please, the last name.
P-O-C-H is the last name.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I have no further questions.
Okay. Mr. Reddy?
Thank you. Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Woodbury, you and I have never met or spoken, correct?
No.
I know you had said you were nervous, so I'm going to try and make
okay.
this fairly brief,
thank you,
sir. I just have a couple of areas that I'd like to go
okay.
with you with. So with regard to your interaction with Karen Reed and what you actually heard from her mouth.
Okay.
That's sort of where I want to concentrate, as opposed to anything that anybody else may have said to you about what they believe she might have said. Okay?
Okay.
And it seems to me that your main interaction with her was not when the initial call came in to respond to, you know, a man who was unresponsive in the snow. It was after you went back to the station in the engine and then came back to the scene for the purposes of the Section 12 that you described. Would that be fair to say?
Correct.
And when you came back to the scene for the Section 12, it's also fair to say that the Section 12 issue was your focus, correct?
Correct.
You had an order in hand, correct?
The police had it, and they gave it to us when we got there.
Right. Okay. So you got an order in hand once you got there?
Correct.
Which is what you expected to happen, correct?
Yes.
And your focus at that point is, okay, and I don't want to be too, you know, flip, but we can do this the easy way or the hard way. Is that a fair characterization?
That is one way to put it.
And you wanted to do it the easy way.
Yes, correct.
And you wanted to persuade Karen Reed that she should want to do it the easy way, correct?
Yes.
And after some conversation back and forth where she was initially resistant, she eventually agreed, yes, I'll do, not to put words in your mouth or hers, but to the effect of, yes, we'll do this the easy way, correct?
Did get her to agree to transport.
And with regard to her state of mind, I believe you had testified that she appeared to be very distraught.
Yes, correct.
Going through a lot of emotions.
Yes.
Grief-stricken.
Oh, that's one of them, yes.
Hysterical at times?
Yes.
Raising her voice at times?
Yes.
Crying at times?
I didn't see any actual tears, but...
That type of
emotional display.
All right. And so in terms of the only commentary that you heard with regard to her feelings or questions regarding John O'Keefe, it was the statements that you heard repetitively over and over and over again. Is he dead? Is he dead? Is he dead? Is he dead?
That was some of the things she was saying, yes.
Your Honor, may we approach sidebar briefly?
Okay. So I think, Ms. Giannetti, I think you need the actual...
Yes. I was going to ask a couple of questions first and then grab it.
But it's right there for when you need it.
Lieutenant Woodbury, on your direct examination, you testified a bit, and I don't want to block a juror here, I'm sorry. You testified a bit about the injuries that you observed on John O'Keefe when you first arrived at the scene, correct?
Yes.
You testified about the swollen eye?
Yes.
And you also testified about the scratch marks that you saw on his forearm, correct?
Correct.
I'd like to show you, I'm going to approach in a minute, to show you what has been marked M for identification. And when I hand it to you, please keep it to yourself and look at it, and then look up at me when you're done, okay? Having reviewed M for identification, do you recognize what that depicts?
Yes.
What does it depict?
That is Mr. O'Keefe's right arm.
All right. Does that photograph appear to be a fair and accurate representation of the scratch marks that you observed on January 29th of 2022, sir?
Yes.
I would offer that, Your Honor.
Okay. That will be our next exhibit. And again, we'll have to maybe renumber. Counsel, before you leave today, we have to figure out how to keep everything straight.
Understood. And with the court's permission, Your Honor, may I have that published on the screen for the jury?
Yes.
On direct examination, Lieutenant, hang on.
Let me just have a moment.
Good point. I'm going to try to get out of your way so everybody can see. With regard to the injuries that you described on direct examination, Lieutenant, I believe you would mainly concentrate.
I'm sorry, I need to. Please take this down for me. I need to counsel.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.